At the end of last lesson in Ruth chapter 2, Ruth has returned to Naomi's home, the home where she's living also. And Ruth is brought back a gift of barley. And Naomi has said to Ruth, "Ruth, where did you glean today to come back with all of this barley?" Because Boaz had noticed her. And not only that, Boaz had allowed her to go right through the middle of the grain fields to pick up grain instead of just trying to gather what was left behind over on the edges of the field, like all the rest of the poor people were doing. Naomi is astonished that Boaz has noticed Ruth. Boaz is an older man. In fact, he is much, much older. And he has noticed Ruth. And not only that, he's been kind to her. And Naomi is really and truly astonished at that. And she says to Ruth that he is a close relative. And Naomi is very desirous to make sure that Ruth is cared for and the future is cared for. And so Naomi decides to make a plan, a very special plan, as any mother-in-law would make, because her daughter has been noticed by a man who can be the redeemer of the family. And so Naomi says to Ruth, we pick up here in chapter 3, verse 1, then that Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? And now is not Boaz, our kinsman, with those maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight." How in the world does Ruth know that Boaz is going to stay outside of town, at least a mile outside of town? There's a circle around every single town between the first edge of town and the first mile that was always reserved for the priest, the Levites, to use that ground for free. They could not own that ground, but they were able to use that ground to grow crops if they needed. So Boaz's land had to be at least 1 mile out of town. And Naomi says to Ruth, Boaz is going to be winnowing the grain tonight. How does she know? Well, here's how she knows. The winnowing process went like this. They would take the sheaves, basically they cut the stalks and the grains are hanging on the ends of the stalks. You've seen that as you've driven down through the fields. They would go to a flat place, they'd call it the threshing floor, and they would begin to beat that grain on the floor. And as they beat it, the grain would fall off and the stalks would be left. After most of the grain was off the stalk, they would take the stalks and they would go over it and use it to build a fire. They would burn it and such. The grain laying on the floor was not purely clean yet because it had lots of what we call chaff, or the inedible part of the stalk that has fallen with it. They would then take a stick that had a fan on it, not a broom, but a fan. They would take that fan, scoop it underneath, throw the grain up into the air, and if the wind was blowing at just about the right speed, it would blow the chaff away and the heavy grain would fall to the ground. The perfect wind for doing this, of which it was the wind that they always used, was the wind that came off of the west, from the west, over the Mediterranean Sea. It would be a steady wind. It would not be too strong. It would not be too weak. It would always be just right. The north wind was always way too strong. The east wind would come in spurts, which when they threw it up, it would waste their time because the grain would fall in between the spurts and the gusts of wind that would come. The south wind was just as bad, and the south wind rarely came because of the distance it would have to pass. Usually the wind was coming from the west, the north, or the east in that area, and still today. But when the west wind came over that sea, it would be just a steady breeze, just a light, steady breeze. So as they threw the grain into the air, that light chaff or trash would blow off to the side and the grain would fall down. And after they had cleaned most of the grain, they'd pile it into a heap and they'd bring some more over and they'd do it again. That's the winnowing at the threshing floor. Evidently, the wind was blowing from the west that day, because Naomi knew and told Ruth that he is going to be there tonight. He will not be going back home tonight. They will do it after 6 p.m. because the wind blows, it's cool, it's nice, and it's easy to do after 6 p.m. So Boaz will be there tonight, Naomi tells Ruth. Then look what she says to her. Ruth, I kind of like to add, I've got a plan, and here's my plan. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do. And she said to her, Naomi, all that you say, I will do. Naomi knows that Boaz is a close enough relative to be the redeemer for their family. They have no male in their family that can go down and do business transactions and sell the grain or whatever they might have. That cannot be done by a woman. It has to be done by a man. They need someone to redeem the family. Ruth and Naomi evidently still have the land in their possession that belonged to Naomi's father and the two dead boys, of which Ruth was married to one of them. That land cannot be sold by a woman at the gate. It has to be sold by a man. And the man is called the Redeemer, the man who will redeem the land and buy it and pay for it, only to hold it so that whenever a son is born in that family, that son can be raised on that land as if it is his, because it really is, but it is kept by the Redeemer until that son is of age, and then it is given to that son to carry on the inheritance so that tribal member will not lose that portion of land that belongs to him. It's called the kinsman redeemer. And Boaz is a relative, and Naomi knows it. And she says, wash yourself. Anoint yourself with perfume, some of that olive oil that has spices in it. Put that on so you smell nice. Put on your best clothes. Don't put on your rags. Don't put on the clothes that you're going to go down to glean from. No. When that gleaning is done, go wash yourself. Go anoint yourself with oil. Put on the very best you have to go and meet your Redeemer. Look at what I wrote in the paragraph there right after that, where it says, picking up with the second line, she does not want Ruth to present herself to her Redeemer in her everyday clothing or without washing and putting on perfume. We should stand before our Redeemer in such a manner. We should wear our best clothing to meet the true Redeemer, whatever our best is. Worshiping our Redeemer is a special occasion worthy of wearing our best. Folks, most of the churches today have lost that vision. Most of our churches, across the board. Our people come to meet their Redeemer and to worship their Redeemer in a place where their Redeemer is, and they can feel like closest to Him in rags. Oh, they may have bought them that way, and they may have paid $175 for that pair of jeans that has no knees in them and are rags and tags. And yes, they may come with their shirts hanging out and holes in it and cruddy looking. And yet, whenever they get dressed for a funeral or for a wedding or for a dance that they may be going to, they dress much better than they do to come to worship. There's something wrong with that, folks. There's something wrong with that. We should prepare ourselves to go meet our Redeemer with the best we have. Now, if the best you have is a pair of blue jeans that don't have any oil on them, because that's the only pair that don't have any oil on them, put those on. Choose your best when you come to worship the Lord and to meet your Redeemer. It is a pet peeve of mine. And I have been preaching this for months and years. Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Jim, my grandfather that adopted and raised me was a Scot. And his theory, and he was a preacher, and his theory was, you're going to meet the king. Dress worthy.
Yeah, let me repeat that. But he still says his grandfather, who's a Scot, said that whenever you're going to worship, you're going to meet the king. So dressed worthy to go meet the king. And folks, I want you to do something when you dress worthy. Dress worthy and dress in your best enough that you feel comfortable in it. That means do it weekly. You've seen it. You've gone to funerals where the first time that young man who's a pallbearer for the first time has had a suit on is that day, and he can't get used to it. And he's more worried about what he looks like than what he's there to do. And you've seen it also with the little kids who wear their best and they can't get used to it. And so they're always doing this with their... And folks, even the adults do this as they do, because you can tell they're not used to it. You know who the new people are on the block. Just tell them, go ahead and keep wearing your best. You'll get used to it so that you can focus on the Redeemer. It's very important. Naomi here warns Ruth to be careful not to distract Boaz in any way as he's doing his work. But when he gets through with his work, notice where he goes to lay down. He is not going to go home. He is going to stay there with the work because they're going to work from 6 o'clock probably till about midnight. Or until all the grain that they have collected in the past few days, because they've been waiting on that west wind to come in until they have taken care of that, because there really was no other way to do it. Folks, they could not plug in their electric fan as we do today. There was no such thing as electric fans. And they could use other fans to cause a breeze, but when God is doing it for you, it always works so much better. When God brings the breeze. So Ruth goes and she says, I'm going to do it. Now listen, there are some commentaries that have said that what Naomi is asking Ruth to do is to enter into an intimate relationship with Boaz. They have not studied well. Take those commentaries, tear them up and throw them in the trash. That is not the tradition. The tradition of uncovering the feet was the tradition of going to a kinsman redeemer, a man who is a relative who has the ability to redeem you and to uncover the lower part of his legs for the purpose of saying, I have a request to make of you. There is nothing wrong with this. He was not at this, Naomi is not asking Ruth this. To go and to have an intimate relationship, she's asking her to go do and what is proper so Boaz will notice her and ask her what her request is. Now, we don't know that there's a request going on right now. We will catch that as we go through. Tradition tells us that there was a request. I'm telling you, tradition tells us that Ruth is going to go to Boaz with a written request from Naomi. And we'll catch that as we finish the lesson. So she went down, verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that the mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Was Boaz drunk? No, he wasn't drunk. Mm-mm. The work was done. His belly was full, his thirst was quenched, and he saw the heap of grain that had been gathered. He was pleased. He was happy with the day's work, and he laid down. And as he laid down, and in his tiredness, he slept off to sleep, drifted off. Ruth did as she was told. She goes and she lays back the edge of the cover to uncover his feet and lays down at the end of his feet. What happens? Then he said, Boaz. Oh, I'm sorry. Then it happened. Verse 8. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled. Can't you imagine? He probably went to turn over, and then his foot hit Ruth probably and went and said this. And he bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid so that for you are a close relative. That was the telltale sign. If he was to take his blanket and throw it back over her, he was saying to her, I am your kinsman. I am your close relative. I will grant you your request. I am willing to do what you ask. I am going to take care of you, is what he would be saying by doing that, because that's the tradition. Then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first. How has she shown her last kindness to be better than the first? There it is. By not going after young men, whether poor or rich. See, Boaz is an old man. He is not a young man. In fact, he has to be old. He has to be at least 78, 79, or 80 years old. There is, oh, sorry. That is not old. Thank you. No, that is true. Since that's just around the corner for me too. But to take a young wife who is probably 27, 28, or 29, I am not sure that is what everyone would call appropriate at this point in time. It seems, as we have watched TV and have seen that those things happen where an old man has taken a very, very young wife, we have all had our opinions about that, of which we will not go through at this point in time. She says it's her kindness. She has come to Boaz. Her first kindness was how she treated Naomi, her mother-in-law, to be there. Her second kindness is this, that she comes to Boaz. Verse 11, and now, my daughter, do not fear. Here's a little clue. I will do for you whatever you ask. You see, there it is. She has a request in her hand. She has gone through the proper traditional thing. She has gone up. She has uncovered his feet. Whether he be awake or asleep, had she gone up to him to ask a request as a kinsman redeemer, as he was awake, sitting in a chair, she would have gone and taken his garment and laid it back over his feet to say, I have a request. He says, I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. She's a Moabite. She's not even supposed to be in the assembly of the people in any of the town. She is supposed to be forbidden to come in as a Moabite. And yet, she has won the hearts of everyone because of how she treated her mother-in-law. Remember the Deuteronomy passage that I read you last week? Down to the 10th generation, after the writing of the law of the Deuteronomy code, Moabites and Ammonites were not to be in the assembly of the people because of their sinful nature. Well, we're right at the tail end of that. We're at the tail end of the 10th generation at this point in time. That curse on those Moabites and Ammonites is fixing to pass away. But up to this time, all the Jews still knew those Deuteronomy codes that they were trying to follow. In fact, that probably is one reason that the closest relative will not redeem her. We'll get to that in a minute. Verse 12, and now it is true, I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. That actually is probably one of my favorite verses in this entire book. Because it says to me that Boaz is a man like I want to be, even in my old age or in my young age, a man of integrity. He has a beautiful young woman who is laying at his feet. He could throw the cover over her and take her and redeem her, but he says, I cannot do so because I am not the one first in line to be your redeemer. I am not the one first in line to have the responsibility to take the land and purchase it and use it as my own, caring for it until I pass it on as an inheritance to the one who it truly belongs to. Boaz was not going to take advantage of Ruth and Naomi, because there was one closer. He didn't have to go to the gate. He didn't have to go do it. He could have done it himself. But no, he knew there was someone closer. He says, I can't do it. His integrity would not let him do it. Verse 13, he says this to Naomi. Look here. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you. Who is he? The closer relative from the verse before. If he will redeem you, good. Let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you. See the promise? Evidently, the note has asked. Naomi has asked Ruth to ask Boaz to redeem them. And Boaz has said, I can't because I'm not the right one. But I know who the right one is. And if he doesn't redeem you, I promise you, I will redeem you. So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. That means she rose in the dark. And he said, he didn't say this to Ruth. Look who he's saying this to. Let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Catch it. He's saying it to the maids and to the servants. He is not the only one who was there that night. No one went home. The master was still in the field. The master was still working. The master laid down there to sleep, and that meant that the maids and the servants laid down to sleep there too. The heap of grain was there. They were going to get up the next morning. They were going to reap some more because the master was there. Had they gone back to the house, everybody was there that worked for him, all the maids, all the servants. They all saw Ruth there. They knew Ruth was there. And so Boaz says, let it not be known that Ruth was here. Why? Because Boaz has a plan. He has an important plan. And he doesn't want to, as I would say proverbially, cast pearls before swine. He's telling his maids and his servants, don't you tell anyone. And I'm going to go ahead with the story. He says, I'm going to the gate today and I'm going to get this handled today. And I don't want you to say anything to anybody until this transaction is over. Folks, listen. Tribes are tribes and nations are nations and people are people. It doesn't matter where they are. And everybody that worked for Boaz knew that Ruth was at his feet that night because they were all out there around the campfire. And Boaz gave his employees instructions. He had a plan, and he did not want his plan to be thwarted. And because people are people, things like this just cannot be kept quiet. There are important things in life that you must keep quiet, and there are important things that you must do, and you must do it today. There are things that matter not a hill of beans in this life at all. But there are things that have to be done today. Some of you have list upon list upon list of things that make absolutely no matter in this world whatsoever. You scratch out things on your list and you rewrite lists over and over and over. And the stuff really doesn't matter. But with every single person that I've ever seen that does that, there's always something on that list they keep pushing to another day. And that was the thing that was important that needed to be done. Nothing else mattered. You let all the chaff get in the way, the trash of things you think are important. So it is in my house. You know, out in my garage, I got projects that are not finished yet, have been sitting there for years and years and years. I got cars that are in parts and have not been finished. And you know what? If they never get finished, it is okay because it is not important in life that those cars get finished. If they end up being hauled off to the metal yard, so be it. But you let something happen with my wife and my daughter and my family or whoever, and if I don't take care of it today, I have sinned. There are things that are important today. And all that stuff out in my garage, I've told you many, many times, everything that is near and dear to me besides my wife and my daughter is out in the garage because that's where we have placed it. Isn't that terrible? And my house is beautiful and spick and span, and you can eat off the floors because everything that's near and dear to my wife is in the house. And nothing that is near and dear to my wife is in the garage. Isn't that right? That's absolutely right. And you know what? My garage has stuff in it that literally and truly, ever so often, I just back up the truck and start throwing stuff in because I realize it's not important and I'm not going to use it and I'm not going to fix it. I put it in that truck. I come down and I say to the helping hands guys, will y'all go throw this in the dumpster? And you know how much of that stuff gets put in the dumpster? None. They take it to their garages. You're welcome. And I wish they'd go ahead and just sell it and get rid of it because it's just not important. Well, Ruth spends that night at Boaz's feet. And she gets up before dark, before the light comes up, so she can slip back into Bethlehem. She can get back to Naomi's house. And look what happens, verse 15. And again, he said to Ruth, she's not left yet. That's where she's headed, to Bethlehem. Give me your cloak that is on you and hold it. And she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. He had to help her put it on her shoulders so she could carry it. Let me explain what this means. See, y'all would just read past that. That's what I'm here for. You pay me for this. A dry measure of anything in the Bible is 2.175 bushels. He put 6 times 2.175 bushels of barley in her cloak, tied it up, and helped her get it up to where she could haul it into town. That's almost 13 bushels of grain. That's the reason why he said he had to lay it on her. She didn't carry it in her hands. She had to put it on her back.
Is it as big as that drum?
I don't know. But it also is barley. I mean, barley's not as heavy as wheat, so you know it's by dry measurement, not by weight. All right. And so she takes it in. Boaz does not want her to go into town empty-handed. There's been a request. Look on, verse 16. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, that's the mother-in-law said, Naomi says, how did it go, my daughter? You would have said the exact same thing. You have been waiting and waiting to see how things turned out last night. And in Ruth slips in, my daughter, how did it go? And she told her all that the man had done. And Ruth said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Do you catch what he has done and what he is saying? He is saying, I will redeem you if I can. I promise that. And this is a gift to prove to you that I will do what is important for me to do to take care of you. Verse 18. And then Naomi said, wait, my daughter. Ruth, wait. Until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it tomorrow, next day. No, today. He is going to the gate, to the court, today to settle the problem, to make the transaction, to do the redemption. He's going to settle it today. Folks, I want you to understand, there are some times in this life when the Redeemer is doing His work, you only thing you can do is wait. When your spouse is in the hospital and all things have been done, all you can do is wait on the Redeemer. When you don't know how things are going to turn out in the next few days because of circumstances that have happened that have seemed to cause your life to crater, it is time for you to turn to the Redeemer and wait. Notice what I said here. Read with me. Wait, ... until you know how the matter turns out. Sometimes there is nothing else that can be done except to wait for the Redeemer. He will not tarry. He is working all for our good. He is jumping the legal hurdles. There's a D there. It's supposed to be hurdles with an R, okay? He is maneuvering all the cast of characters into just the right place for his plan to work. The maids cannot help, and neither can the servants. Those being redeemed can do nothing to speed along the process. Only the Redeemer can handle the matter. Ruth and Naomi must wait to hear if Boaz or the other closer relative will be their redeemer. All we can do is wait. Wait. Now, most of y'all have known me for a long time. Almost all of you have. There's a character, I don't know if it's a character flaw or just an incredible characteristic that I have. The characteristic is this, and I like the way it was said to me this week. I just plod along doing the work. Just plod. Job gets done. I'm not going to do it too fast. I'm not going to do it too slow. I'm just going to plod along to get the work done. And you let a hiccup come at me or somebody throw a curveball, do you know what I do in those processes? I just stop. I just stop to wait to see what the Lord, the Redeemer, is doing. I don't press on and say, we got to get it done anyway. We got to get it done anyway. Got to get it done. No, I don't do that. Those of y'all who worked out at Danbury, we do the same thing. Yep. We'd do it two times or three times, and it still wouldn't work out, and so we'd go to a different project for a while, and we'd wait. Because in our ignorance, we weren't doing something right. And lo and behold, it would not be very long before another volunteer would show up, and that was his forte. He knew exactly what to do. And instead of us rushing in where fools rush in, we would wait on the Redeemer. I had a bad advice from a man when I was younger. His motto was, I may not always make the right decision, but it doesn't take me long to make a decision. And so I made that my motto for early on. You know what? It didn't work out very well for me. It really didn't. Because I thought I had to make a decision whether it was right or wrong. Now through the scripture I know that we don't have to make a decision whether it's right or wrong. We have to wait on the Redeemer to reveal to us what the true decision should be. And so my motto now is, if you don't know, don't. And it'll sure save you a whole lot of money. And it'll sure keep you out of a pack of trouble. Well, all they can do is wait. Now about Boaz, chapter 4, verse 1. If you don't notice, we just changed a chapter. Please don't use chapter breaks here. Don't use chapter breaks anywhere in the Old Testament. When you're studying the Bible, Bible study 101, forget the chapter breaks and the verses. Only use them as references. Because in most cases, they stop the story where the story should not be stopped. When we get into our next passage, our next lesson we're going to start next week, I wish we could do it all in one sitting because it really is one message. It's going to take us 4 weeks. But it really is one message that we need to hear the entire message. But we can't do it that way. We can't do this one. I wish this was all been one message. Don't stop at the chapter breaks when you're studying. Keep reading on. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, turn aside, friend, and sit down here. And he turned and sat down. You see, all the business was not handled in a courtroom. It was handled at the gate. That's where everything happened in every city in the promised land. And in comes the closer relative. He knows him. You know how he knows? Because he's a relative of the relative. He's Boaz's relative too. He's Naomi's relative. He's Boaz's relative. Because they're all from the same line of the tribe of tribes. They're all related. They all come from the descendant of one man who formed with his family this town that we know as Bethlehem. So he's turned aside. And then look, he says, and he took 10 men of the elders. 10 of the elders, because this is what these elders did. They came to the city gates, and they sat at the city gates, and they waited to be a witness of transactions. And he said to them, sit down here. So they sat down also. It's what they did. It's how everything was done, was at the city gates. Then he said to the close relative, here's the deal. This is where we know that Ruth had a request from Naomi when she uncovered his feet. We've got to catch it. It's not told to us, but we catch it when we know the traditions and the customs. Naomi has come back from the land of Moab. She has to sell the piece of land which belongs to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here, meaning the elders. Do it as a legal transaction, and before the elders of my people. And if you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, Tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Close relative, here's the land. There's the land to be sold. Naomi has it. It's you're the first one in line. Redeem it if you want to, but let me know if you don't, because if you won't, I will. And the man says, I will redeem it. Now, if you were Boaz, I wonder what your heart just did. Did your stomach just turn upside down? Did your heart just drop? I'm not sure it did, because Boaz is a wise and wealthy man, and he has a plan. So then Boaz said, all right, close relative, I wish we knew his name, but we don't. On the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Oh, this close relative knows exactly what that means. She's a Moabitess, and he has to take her too. Now listen, he's going to redeem the land. That means he's got to take Naomi also. That's a mouth to feed. Now he's got to take a Moabitess. That's not only a mouth to feed, but the law said a Moabitess cannot even be within the assembly of the people. He says, I can't. He must have a child and raise that child on that land in the name of the Father, on his inheritance, and when the son becomes of age, he must give that land back to that son to be his. And the close relative says, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. I can't. I'm sure that close relative must have been younger than Boaz, and probably his father was still alive. And there are prejudices that go down through every single generation to generation. And I'm sure that young close relative was thinking about, if I take this Moabite woman into my family and have a child with it, my father that's still alive will disinherit me, and I will not get all that's mine. It's all about money, isn't it? It's all about money. With Boaz, it's not about money, folks. That has nothing to do about money. Boaz is already wealthy. He wants to do it out of kindness, not because of money. Redeem it for yourself, he tells Boaz. You may have the right of my redemption, for I cannot redeem it. Well, I bet that just made Boaz happy, and it did. Now, this was the custom in the former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. Took off his sandal and gave it to Boaz. Now actually there's more to this process. Had Naomi been there instead of being back at the house waiting to hear how everything turned out, Naomi would have been responsible to do something else. Rather disgusting in today's life. But some of y'all, you women, would have loved to have the opportunity to do this. Deuteronomy says, let's pick up this Deuteronomy 23. Here's the law, right out of Deuteronomy 23:3. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of the dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. But if the man does not desire to take his wife's brother, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duties of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of the city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Had Naomi been there, she could have come up, grabbed his sandal, and spit in his face. Do you know why probably Naomi was not there that day? Because she wanted Ruth with Boaz, not the nearest relative. Now, that's just speculation. But I bet when you all get to heaven, what a day, glorious day that will be, when we all finally get there, lo and behold, we'll all find out that I was right. Ask that question. Put that on your heaven bucket list of questions that you have to ask. But I think Ruth is very pleased with what has happened. Then Boaz said to the elders of all the city, "You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belongs to Elimelech and all that belongs to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon." There we go. We finally know. Last week we didn't know in the opening which one was her husband. Now we know as Mahlon was Ruth's husband. "I have taken the widow of Mahlon to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brother or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." The legal transaction is done. I wish we could do things that easy around here. Of course, then you don't see it here, but Boaz then had to pay the elders to take care and be witnesses of the legal transaction. And you say, how in the world did they know whose sandal was whose? I mean, didn't they all look the same? No, they didn't all look the same. They were all handmade. They all looked a little different. And everyone knew that they put a mark on that shoe, that sandal, and it was given to Boaz. Those elders basically signed the shoe and gave it to Boaz, and that was the legal abstract that said, Boaz has been the redeemer. And all the people who were in the court and the elders said something. All the people, they said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel." Rachel and Leah, two of the four wives of Jacob. They had handmaids. Rachel and Leah both had handmaids. And those handmaids gave Jacob sons, and so did Rachel and Leah. Rachel only gave Jacob, Joseph, and Benjamin before she died. Leah gave him four sons. And then there were the others came from the two handmaids of these two that their father had given to them as they'd left the house. When Jacob left the house, I want to understand this, Jacob did not have a son until he was 77 years old. His first son was born when Jacob was 77 years old. His last son, Benjamin, was born whenever Jacob was 92 years old, and Joseph was born when he was 91 years old. Jacob was an old man when he had children, as old men go, as we've already covered that. In the span of life of normally having children, have I just offended just all of y'all today? I guess I have. You know what I mean. Well, they ask the blessing here. Moreover, they go on to say, may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah. Jacob's son Judah had three sons. Actually had four. Son dies, and the other son, the oldest son, is supposed to do his duty in this Deuteronomy thing, and his name is Onan, and he decides not to do it correctly, and she does not bear a son, and Onan dies. And then the next son comes along to perform the duty, and he is wicked, and the Lord kills him. And then finally there's one young, very young son. And when I mean young, I mean under 10 years of age. And Jacob says, he is too young to give to you, to be a husband to you. So wait until he grows up and I will give him to you. And so Tamar waits and waits and waits and waits, and the son grows. And Judah does not give that young son to Tamar. So Tamar gets upset, and she devises a plan. And when Jacob comes into the city one day or out to the area, Tamar dresses up like she is a rather loose lady of the evening. And Judah decides to have a relationship with her that night. And for payment, he does not bring anything to pay, so she takes his belt and his stick as a earnest money that he will send her the payment of the little kid whenever he returns back to the flock, the kid not being a child, but being an animal, a lamb. Months go by, 3 months go by, and he has not paid his bill because he cannot find her because she has disappeared. And lo and behold, the word comes out that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant. And Judah wants to kill that woman, Tamar. So Tamar is brought to him, and when she comes, she shows him the sash, and she shows him the cane, and they're all handmade. You didn't go buy these in duplicates, folks. And Judah knew that they were his and that he was the man. Born to him was Perez and another boy. They were twins. And Perez is the one who is in the line. He's in this whole generation of line. And after that, after all that happens, about 10 years after that happens, Jacob finally moves all the family to Egypt. So now you know in the timeline where this happens. It happens before they go to Egypt, and now we're way on down after that. We're 400 years after that, in fact. After coming out of Egypt 400 years before. There's 967 years of time being told within this story here. But they want to be blessed because Perez gives a blessing to Jacob and to Judah. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son there in Bethlehem. Look on. Then the woman said to Naomi, the women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today." When the boy is born, they go to Naomi and say, "Naomi, you are so blessed. Not only have you been redeemed by your kinsman redeemer, but the Lord has blessed you with a child, and may his name become famous in Israel. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Those women go on to say something else. They say, "Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap." Naomi takes the grandbaby, the boy, and puts it on his lap and becomes her nurse. It's going to take care of her. It's going to be the child's maid that's going to teach that child to read and to write and to do everything. And the neighbor women gave him a name. The neighbor women gave him a name saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," so they named him Obed. Who named him Obed? The women in Bethlehem, the neighbor women. His name was Obed, but his name was also Mahlon. Mahlon would be his legal name. Obed is the nickname. And it was very common for people to give people nicknames in those days, because the name Obed means serving. And it is the culmination. He is named as the culmination of what Ruth has done for Naomi. Throughout Ruth's life, when she took Mahlon as her husband, she began serving Naomi. Whenever her husband died, she continued to serve Naomi. When her mother-in-law needed food, she went to the fields to gather grain, serving Naomi. Whenever she came home, Naomi says, "I want to protect you. I want to take care of you. It is amazing you went to Boaz's field. Stay there. I've got a plan." When Ruth comes home, she does not come home empty-handed. Boaz wants her to have 13 bushels of grain. Naomi says, "This is wonderful. Here's the plan. Go do this." The plan works, and lo and behold, Obed is born. The writer then, whoever wrote this down, and we are not really sure who wrote the story, but we do know that the story is written down after David has become king. David. Well, who's David? So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David, King David. So this story is such an important story of renown that it is being passed down from generation to generation, as a story to teach women how to be women and men how to be men of integrity. The scripture doesn't end there. The writer gives us a little more like genealogy. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Who is Perez? Perez is the son of Judah and Tamar, the son of Jacob. You follow me? To Perez was born Hezron. To Hezron was born Ram. To Ram was born Amminadab. To Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz was born Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. The author is wanting us to know that this is the lineage. He's also told us some very interesting things. In this genealogy, I just took it and made it into a chart. I added Jacob and Judah so that you could see them. Jacob is born in 2033 B.C. Judah is born in 1953 B.C. Perez is going to be born sometime before 1887 B.C. We know that because he's born not in Egypt, and they go to Egypt in 1875 B.C. Then Hezron, then Ram, and Abinadab, they're all born while they're in Egypt, and so is Nahshon. Nahshon is also born in Egypt, and he is a leader of the tribe of Judah when they come out of Egypt. You know how we know that? We know that because over in Numbers chapter 7, verses 1 through 89, we find out that Nahshon is the man who is selected from the tribe of Judah to help consecrate the tabernacle when it's built. And Nahshon has a son by the name of Salmon, who he goes off into the promised land. So he was either born in the wilderness or just before they left Egypt, because he's not over 20 years of age. And so he gets to go in the promised land. Salmon is Boaz's dad. Oh, my soul. And then Boaz is Obed's dad, and Jesse is... Obed is Jesse's dad, and Jesse is King David's dad, who is born in 1066. Between Nahshon and Jesse, there are only four generations. Do you notice that? We know that Jesse was very, very old when he had David. We know that Boaz is old when he has Obed. There's 321 years here, and the truth of the matter is Nahshon, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, and Jesse had to be at least 80 years of age when they gave birth to each of their sons. It's the only way it works out. And probably they were a little older than that, because Jesse is very old when he gives birth to King David. And so that is the story of Ruth, a story about being kind and being faithful to your family, about having integrity in your life. Well, where are we going next week? Next week, we're going to the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, and that's where we'll go. We'll be in Ecclesiastes for 4 weeks. The lessons are almost completed already, and I did not know where we were going last week, and now I already know. And so that's where we're headed, through the book of Ecclesiastes. Whatever you thought about Ecclesiastes, just kind of put it on the shelf, because it will be different. It won't be that different. But it will be in context, I can tell you that. Lord Jesus, we thank you that you have given us a time to come and to study your word and learn from it. May we as men be like Boaz, and may our women be as Ruth. What an incredible testimony of the integrity of both of this man and this woman. And they should be people of honor because of how they handled themselves in light of you, who was their Messiah too. Lord, we love you in all this. Amen.